gone too. As for my early birthday party at Pecan Grove on October 18th, which starts around 7 in the evening, I play everything by ear. Love, Mama. On the night of October 17th, the day before she and Connor were scheduled to fly from Seattle to Louisiana, Sitta very carefully photographed the old snapshots and memorabilia contained in the scrapbook of Divine Secrets. The photo she took the most care with was a picture she hadn't discovered until she'd returned to Seattle. Tucked into the folds of one of the back pages was the image of a woman, blonde, with dark eyes, holding an auburn-haired baby girl in her lap as she sat on a porch swing. Each of them was dressed in a fetching summer dress and backlit by the sun. Sitta photographed the image several times. With each advancement of the film, she dropped deeper into an appreciation of the moment recorded on that southern swing. When she finished photographing the image, she turned the snapshot over and photographed the inscription on the back. In Vivi's hand were written the following words, Vivi and Sitta, 1953. A beautiful day. A pink dress. Photo by Buggy. After finishing 8 rolls of film, Sitta closed the scrapbook and set it on the dining room table. On either side of the album, she set sanctuary candles, one with an image of Our Lady of Guadalupe and one with a depiction of St. Jude. She lit both candles, turned out all the lights, and said a little prayer of thanks to the Holy Lady and her angels. Tenderly, she took the Divine Secrets of the Yah-Yah Sisterhood album and wrapped it in a silk pillowcase and placed it in a gallon-sized Ziploc bag. Then she tucked it into her carry-on bag, along with a tiny, gift-wrapped package. For the fourth time since she'd boarded the plane, Sitta checked her carry-on to make sure the scrapbook was still safe. Then she took a sip of her Diet Coke and settled back for the flight. "Have I lost my mind?" she asked Connor. "I mean, Vivi Dolan still sounds angry. There's no telling what will happen." "Your mother doesn't own Louisiana," Connor said. "Yes, she does," Sitta said. "She is the queen of central Louisiana. But she's getting old. She won't live forever. I want to see her." "What do you want from this visit?" Connor asked. "Oh, just the perfect healing of all wounds, transcending of all pain, that sort of thing." "What do you want?" "To marry you in your hometown." Sitta choked on a peanut and quickly reached for a quick sip of her Diet Coke. When she recovered, she said, "I'm not going to touch that right now, okay?" "Definitely do not touch it right now," he said. "Not in public." As they flew over the heart of the country, the earth tinged by the reds and golds of October, Sitta and Connor played game after game of gin rummy, betting everything from trips to Tuscany to back rubs to little private pleasures only the two of them knew how to broker. They didn't stop playing until the Boeing 707 landed, just barely, in Houston, where the weather had grown melodramatic. A mean, exciting storm born somewhere off the coast of Africa had Houston in its grip. Sitta's perfectly calculated plans to arrive in Thornton in plenty of time to check into their lodging, shower, change, and make a shining entrance just as Vivi's party kicked off were blown off course. During a 3-hour wait in an airport cafe, Sitta had plenty of time to wonder if her re-entry into the land of tropical depressions and storms was a crazy mistake. "It is hurricane season, after all," she told Connor. "We should have never attempted to make this trip. Jesus." "Last time you were home, when was that? A couple of years ago?" "That was October 2, wasn't it?" "Right," Sitta said. "My goddaughter Lee's baptism."
"No hurricane then, right?" he asked.
"No," she replied. "Just your run-of-the-mill psychic squalls and mental typhoons."
"Well," Connor said, testing her, "maybe we won't make it after all. Maybe we should just check into a hotel here in Houston."
"Are you kidding? And miss the birthday party?
No, no, no. If that plane doesn't take off soon, we're renting a car and driving. That's what I thought, he said. Smarty pants. When the small puddle jumper plane from Houston to Thornton was cleared for takeoff, Sitta took it as a sign. Visibility has increased. This means my mother will not kill me. By the time the plane landed at Thornton's tiny airport, it was almost 10 o'clock at night. They rented a car, cracking up, when the only one available was a big silver deluxe Chrysler New Yorker Fifth Avenue with burgundy leather interior. When they turned off Highway 1 onto Jefferson Street, Sitta wished she smoked. Cocktail hour has come and gone, she told Connor, no telling what shape Vivi Dolan will be in. Daddy either. You know how to wing it.
Yep, Sitta said, trying to control the nausea. I know how to wing it, but I'd sure as hell rather have a finished script in my hands.
At the sight of her parents' home, Sitta slowed the car to a crawl. The long brick house on the rise above the bayou looked different than it did in her memories. The pine trees seemed taller. The pecan trees and azaleas were older, and ivy now covered almost the whole backside of the 6-bedroom brick house. Everything felt more settled and peaceful-looking than she remembered. She could see the small wood frame house at the edge of the field where Willetta and Chaney lived. Something about that little house helped her keep driving toward the much larger house in which she'd grown up.
We've made it this far, Sitta said, creeping the car up the long drive. I guess we might as well at least drop in.
She slowly drove past the bayou to the front of the house. The first thing she saw as she turned off the motor was her parents. They were sitting on a wooden swing under 2 old pecan trees in the front yard. White Christmas lights were strung around the swing set, and Vivi and Shep sat inside their glow. Vivi was wearing a rust and gold-colored silk pantsuit, her ash-blonde hair cut in a smart page boy, which swung from side to side as she moved her head. Shep wore a pair of light gray Dockers and a blue and gray plaid shirt. They both had aged in the past 2 years. Sitta watched for a moment as her mother gestured animatedly with her hands. She did not recognize the person sitting in an Adirondack chair opposite the swing, which surprised her. Sitta believed she should be able to recognize every person in her hometown, in spite of the fact that she hadn't actually lived there in over 25 years. There were very few other cars. Most of the guests had already left. Clearly, her parents did not recognize their unfamiliar rental car. Taking a deep breath, she said a prayer to the Holy Lady and her band of Louisiana angels. Then Sitta started blowing the horn.
Hold my hand and tell me I'm not insane, Sitta whispered to Connor.
You're not insane, he said, and I love you. As Sitta watched her mother rise from the swing and walk toward the car, she noticed how Vivi moved more slowly than she remembered. Her mother seemed to have shrunk a little in height, but other than that, she looked positively robust. With each step Vivi took, Sitta's heart beat faster. When Vivi reached the car, Sitta rolled down the window. It's me, Mama. Her voice sounded foreign. She tried not to feel 5 years old. She tried to feel at least 11. As Vivi leaned her head into the car, Sitta could smell bourbon on her breath, mixed with the painfully familiar Vivi scent.
Sitta? Vivi asked, unbelieving. Is that really you?
Sitta was relieved to hear that her mother was not drunk, only lightly tipsy.
Yes, ma'am, Sitta said. It's me.
Vivi didn't respond for a moment. Sitta wondered if she would turn and walk away. After a beat or two, Vivi put her fingers in her mouth and let rip one of her famous ya-ya whistles.
You crazy fool, what in the world are you doing all the way down here?
I came for your birthday, Sitta said. I decided to take my chances.
Holy mother of pearl, Vivi said,
then turned to Shep and the other guest.
Would y'all believe it? It's Sitta Lee. It's my oldest child.
Sitta stepped out of the car and into her mother's arms. Happy birthday, Mama, she whispered. They embraced for an instant before Vivi's body stiffened and pulled away.
"I can't believe it," Vivi said, nervous. "You nut. I didn't think you'd really come."
Leaving Sitta, she crossed to the car's passenger side and peeked in.
"Who are you?"
I'm Connor McGill, Mrs. Walker, he said, and gave her a slow grin. The minute Connor smiled, Vivi gasped and stepped back from the car, momentarily shaken. Sitta held her breath. Stepping back to the car window, Vivi said,
"Glory, Osco Zero, I do not believe it. What are you doing just sitting there, darling? Get out of this car and let me see you."
Folding his long legs out of the car, Connor stood next to Vivi, who appeared absolutely tiny next to him. As he stood there, relaxed, open, Vivi surveyed him from head to toe. The whole time she studied him, she kept one hand clasped to her chest, like she was trying to keep her heart in place. Sitta had absolutely no idea what her mother might say or do next.
"Ah,"
is all Vivi said at first.
"Ah,"
she said a second time in a small, young voice. Then she wrapped her arms around her waist, which was not a gesture Sitta could recall ever seeing her mother make. Vivi was silent for so long that Sitta wondered if she were experiencing pain. Finally, almost abruptly, Vivi shifted her hands to her hips.
"Sitta," she said, "for God's sake, why didn't you tell me Connor looked exactly like Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?"
Connor laughed. "Mama," Vivi said as she extended her hand to her daughter's lover.
"I have always adored tall men."
Connor then completely shocked Sitta by refusing to shake her mother's hand. Instead, he kissed it. He lowered his lips to Vivi's hand and kissed it. Sitta almost fell on the ground.
"It's a pleasure to finally meet you, Mrs. Walker," he said.
"Oh," Vivi said, "please call me Vivi, or you'll make me feel terribly old."
"You are old, babe,"
Shep Walker said, stepping over to the car.
"Oh, shut up," Vivi said, laughing. "Don't give away my secrets. Shep, this is Connor McGill. Connor, meet my first husband," she said playfully, making it sound like she'd had several.
"Shep Walker,"
Sitta's father said, extending his hand to Connor.
"Connor McGill, sir," Connor said. "A pleasure to meet you."
For a moment, Sitta was left out of the triangle as her mother wrapped up the introductions between the two men. She stood to the side as she witnessed her mother in her favorite 2-men-to-1 Vivi ratio in the old time-honored sport of competitive flirting. Sitta watched her father as he waited for a sign from Vivi that it was all right to welcome his daughter.
"Lucky y'all made it down here with that old storm that was messing around," Shep said.
The wind and rain in Houston were pretty bad," Connor said.
"That's why we're late," Sitta said.
"Storm was heading our way," Shep said. "So glad it changed his mind and headed out into the Gulf."
"The grand old Gulf of Mexico," Vivi said, linking her arm in Connor's. "It's absorbed many storms. Do you know the Gulf, Connor?"
"No," Connor said, "I don't. But Sitta has sure talked about it."
After Connor's subtle refusal to continue excluding Sitta, Vivi turned to her husband and said,
"Shep, you remember Sitta, don't you? Our child with the national media connections."
Sitta and her father stepped toward each other at the same moment. Hugging his daughter tightly and quickly, Shep whispered in her ear,
"Missed you, babe. Missed you."
Sitta was aware of how her mother policed their hug. "I've got to stay alert," Sitta thought. "Mama is like a hurricane. Same ferocity, same beauty, and you never know where she'll strike down."
"Beautiful place you have here, Mr. Walker," Connor said.
"You'll have to come back in the daylight," Shep said, relieved. "I got me some surprises out in that field, along with my rice and crawfish course."
"Gadzooks," Vivi said. "I've utterly forgotten my guests. My manners are going to hell in my dotage." "Darling, come over here right this minute,"
she called out to the person they'd been chatting with when Connor and Sitta arrived. A small, wiry man of around 70 stepped toward the car. He was wearing a plaid bow tie and a finely tailored shirt, looking a little like a cross between an aging horse jockey and Mr. Peepers.
"Sida, baby," he said, and without hesitation gave her a long, warm hug. "Teensy was right. You look ravishing."
"Chick," Sida said, "it's wonderful to see you."
"You must be Kana,"
Chick said, giving him a kiss on the cheek in the European fashion.
"I'm Latinsi's lesser half. She raved about you. Welcome to Thornton, where the sin-loving southern half of the state meets the atonement-hungry north."
Putting his arms around Sida again, Chick looked at her face.
"And the nose looks terrific."
"The nose?" Connor said.
"She took half of that little upturned beauty off on our diving board doing her first cutaway," Chick explained. "Thrilled to see it grew back."
It felt luxurious to have Chick's arms around her. The smoking bunny, she thought, as she remembered the Easter he and Teensy helped keep her family pasted together.
"You darling man," she said to him, smiling. "Where is Teensy? Where are all the yah-yahs?"
"Latines needed her beauty rest," Chick said. "Nisi and Carol followed suit. I'm the last of the Red Hot share, and I'm not Red Hot for long. About time for me to vamoose. I've probably worn out my welcome as it is." "Never," Vivi said. "You know that." "Terrific party," Chick said, stepping away from Sita to give Vivi a kiss. "Happy birthday again, Vivo. Impossible to believe you're 39. Gives new definition to the word timeless."
Vivi laughed and kissed him again.
"Nah, Chick," Shep said, putting his arm around the smaller man's shoulders. "Thanks for all your help." "Bonsoir, Sida, Kana," Chick said, heading toward an immaculately restored Bentley.
"Sida, please don't snitch and tell your amoureux that I'm a folk agent. I can't help if I only married into majesty."
As Chick was driving off, Shep said,
"I believe I'll turn in. I'm not good for much after 10 p.m. these days." "I'm shocked you lasted this long," Vivi said. "Little bird told me we might have a surprise tonight," he said, giving Sida an almost indiscernible wink. "You know how yah-yahs can talk."
Sida gave her father a quick peck on the cheek. "Good night, Daddy," she said. "Love you."
"Love you, Butterbean," he said. "Love you bunches."
As Shep walked back to the house, Sida became aware of raucous laughter coming from somewhere behind the house.
"Who's that? Are there still guests out back?"
"Ah, Lady of Pearl," Vivi said. "I almost forgot about them. That's your Uncle Pete and the boys out on the dock. They have been back there playing Bouray for God knows how long."
"Bouray?" Connor asked, his eyes opening wide.
"But of course," Vivi Walker said, raising her eyebrows.
She led them in the direction of the bayou.
"Do you play, Connor?"
No, ma'am," Connor said.
It floored Sida to hear Connor say, "No, ma'am." She knew those words had never crossed his Yankee lips before.
"Sida's only told me about Bouray," he said. "I've always wanted to sit in on a game."
"Connor's an ace poker player, Mama," Sida said. "He has regular poker nights in New York, Maine, and Seattle. Every theater he designs for, he's got a group of poker buddies." Sida knew that Vivi Walker automatically liked anybody who played cards. It didn't matter if they were liars or embezzlers or Republicans. If they played a decent hand, they were okay by Vivi.
"What in the world could Sida tell you about Bouray?" Vivi asked. "She's never played in her life."
"You're right, Mama," Sida said. "I told Connor what a crackerjack Bouray player you are."
"Said you were one of the best in the state," Connor said.
Vivi stopped for a moment and looked first at Connor and then at Sida.
"Y'all are trying to please me," she said, giving them a wide, grateful grin. "Okay, I'm easy."
It made Sida want to cry when she saw how much this small effort delighted her mother.
"I am thoroughly impressed that you have taken up with a card-playing man, Sida Lee," Vivi said as she continued walking. "I shall look forward to taking his hard-earned money away from him sometime in the near future."
Vivi led Connor and Sitta back to a little dock that extended out over the bayou behind the Walker home. On the dock sat a card table and two old floor lamps, from which ran a long orange extension cord that disappeared in the direction of a small playhouse where Sitta used to stage her tea parties. A small camp stool that held a platter of food was positioned between the lamps. On folding chairs around the table sat Sitta's brothers, Baylor and Little Shep, her mother's brother, Pete, and her cousin, John Henry Abbott. Irma Thomas was singing the blues from a portable CD player positioned next to a cooler. Spanish moss hung like wild witch hair from the trees that leaned out over the bayou. "Ain't no doubt," Sitta thought, "I'm right smack in the heart of Louisiana." She wanted to lift the tableau up, set it down on a stage, and say, "This is where I come from." But this wasn't a scene she could direct. She was in the middle of one sweet, messy, unpredictable improvisation. When the four card players spotted Sitta, each man's jaw dropped. Sitta knew exactly what they were thinking. Hold on to your seat, Vivi and Sitta in the same state. If they'd been wearing holsters, their hands would have been on their pistols. Sitta knew the scenes they'd had to witness down there in the thick of things. Baylor refusing to represent Vivi in a lawsuit against Sitta. Vivi's letters sent certified mail to everyone in the extended family announcing that she had disowned her oldest daughter. Vivi's highly publicized in Thornton firing of the lawyer who'd represented the Walkers for decades because he dared advise her to think it over before she cut Sitta out of the will. Vivi's month-long attempt to reach Arthur Ox Sulzberger, Jr., publisher of the New York Times, to give him a piece of her mind. Vivi's wild attempt to force the Garnett Parish Library to burn their issue and the microfiche of the New York Times that carried the offending article. Then Vivi's desperate cancellation of her library card when they refused. And, of course, her delight in the subterfuge when she later reapplied for a card under an assumed name. Baylor had kept Sitta informed of all this, hoping to make her laugh at the small-town drama, but it had only broken her orphaned heart. Now, as she looked at her four male relatives, she did not blame them for hesitating before they spoke. Baylor was the first to break their standstill. He made the sign of the cross, then slapped his hand of cards down on the table and sauntered over to Sitta. Once he reached her, he picked her up in the air, swung her around, and pretended he was about to throw her into the bayou. "Go ahead," the other Bure players yelled. "Do it. She's been dry too long. She needs a bayou baptism." "Don't you dare," Sitta hollered, delighted. At the last minute, Baylor stopped short. Instead, he set her feet back on the ground and gave her a bear hug. "What is this, you little snake? How'd you ever get into Hooterville without me, the grand gatekeeper, knowing? I thought they confiscated your passport." "She's a sly one," Vivi said. Turning to Little Shep, who had not yet risen from the card table, Sitta said in pig Latin, "Hey, hey, Epshe." "Come over here, big sister," he said, "and give me a hug." "Thought we'd never see you again," Little Shep said as he stood and hugged Sitta with all his nearly 200 pounds. "God, you're beautiful," he said, looking at her. He stroked her hair. "Your hair, your skin. How come you look so good?" "Luck, love," Sitta said. "A nearsighted little brother." Little Shep laughed. "No, I mean it. Women down here don't stay looking as good as you, Sitta." "I beg your big fat pardon," Vivi said. "No, Mama," Little Shep said. "I mean the ones in my age group." "Better stop while you're ahead, son," Uncle Pete said. "How you been, Shep?" Sitta asked. "Can't complain, sis," he said. "Playing the hand I've been dealt. Sorry I never wrote you back. You know how life is, huh?" "Sitta," Uncle Pete said, stepping over to give her a hug. "Glad to see you home. It's been too long." Immediately after hugging Sitta, Pete protectively put his arms around Vivi's shoulders. "Birthday girl," he said with fondness. "How's my little stinky doing?" Laughing, Vivi held her brother's hand to her heart. "This just might turn out to be one of my favorite birthday fêtes so far," she said. "Everybody's here, except Lulu."
"Where is Lulu?" Sitta asked.
Sitta's younger sister didn't stay in touch, and since the New York Times upset, Sitta had lost all track of her.
"Tallulah is in Paris," Vivi said. "Left her interior design business with her partner and took off for France."
"Took off with a Frenchman is more like it," Baylor said.
"His family owns a winery somewhere, and his divorce should be final any day," Vivi said.
Turning to Connor, who'd been quietly watching the reunion, Sitta said, "I want y'all to meet Connor McGill, my Yankee sweetheart. He is, by the way, a hell of a card player." Connor groaned loudly.
"No, no," he said. "She's got it all wrong. She has me confused with some other Yankee. We all look alike. I don't know a queen from a deuce. I mean, a two."
"Yeah, right," Baylor said, reaching out and shaking Connor's hand. "I've heard about you Maine boys. Killers. All those long winters. Pull up a chair, pal. Have a brewski. We'll be happy to take you to the cleaners. I mean, introduce you to the cutthroat world of Louisiana bourrée. My big brother and I here learned the game at our mother's feet while she was weaning us on bourbon spike baby bottles."
"You crazy fool," Vivi said, loving every minute. "It was Tabasco, not bourbon." Laughing, Connor asked, "What's a foreigner got to do to get a beer on this dock?"
"Help yourself, Connor," Uncle Pete said. "Some cold shrimp and fried frog legs still left."
"Guess I better if I'm gonna swim with the bayou sharks," Connor said, opening a bottle of beer and pulling up a chair. Everybody laughed. They liked Connor. Sitta liked Connor. She could not stop smiling as she watched her Yale-educated scenic designer release the good old boy within. Connor took a long swig of his beer, then stood up. He put his beer on the table, walked over to Sitta, and leaned her back in his arms. Then, for no good reason other than bayou voodoo, he planted a huge wet kiss right on her lips. The whole bourrée gang let out a holler as Vivi watched, eagle-eyed. Sitta loved it. As Vivi led Sitta back in the direction of the house, she said, "Most of the food has been put away already, but come on, let me fix you a plate." While Vivi went inside the kitchen, Sitta walked out to the front yard and sat down on the swing. A Cajun cooker was set up nearby, along with several tables. "Laissez les bons temps rouler," Sitta thought. "A birthday crawfish boil." Sitta watched as her mother walked back out toward the swing. "She's not as feverish," Sitta thought. Vivi paused for an instant, a momentary hesitation that seemed to border on shyness. It was only for a beat, then she continued on to where Sitta sat on the swing. She handed Sitta a glass of champagne and a plate piled high with boiled crawfish, new potatoes, corn on the cob, and hunks of buttered French bread. "Thank you, Mama," Sitta said, realizing just how hungry she was.
"Your daddy prepared the whole meal," Vivi said. "I didn't have to do a thing. I'm sorry there's so little left. My guests just gobbled everything up."
"Well, this is plenty," Sitta said.
"Can you handle eating that crawfish here on the swing, or should we move to the table? Mama, I have not forgotten how to suck the heads of a Louisiana crawfish wherever I'm sitting." "Here's a couple of napkins," Vivi said, pulling two large squares of pink linen out of her waistband.
After tucking one of the napkins into the collar of her blouse as a bib and the other under her plate, Sitta began to shell the crawfish.
"Will you join me?" Sitta said, gesturing to a spot beside her on the swing.
"Thank you for offering me a seat on my own swing," Vivi said in a tone that Sitta couldn't quite read.
Vivi sat down, although not so close that their bodies touched. She stared straight out, keeping one hand behind her back. Sitta could hear her mother breathing. For the first time, Sitta realized she hadn't seen her mother light one cigarette since she'd arrived. Afraid to say the wrong thing, Sitta said nothing. She shelled the crawfish and ate. "This is delicious."
"Thank God Louisiana men know how to cook," Vivi said.
Not as sophisticated in its flavoring as your etouffee, of course.
Niecy made sure you had some? Vivi asked.
I had forgotten food could taste like that, Sitta said.
You really thought it was good?
Good? Mama, the etouffee you sent up with the yayas would have made Paul Prudhomme weep over his cast-iron skillet. That man is a short-order cook compared to you.
Well, thank you. I am known for that dish, if you recall. I learned how to cook it from Genevieve Whitman.
Thank you for sending it to Quinault, Mama.
The one thing I did right was feed y'all well, Vivi said.
Something in Vivi's tone struck Sida. Mama is as nervous as I am, she thought. She turned to Vivi and said, You did more right than wrong.
Vivi did not respond. Neither mother nor daughter knew what to say next.
You look good, Mother. Really good.
You look terrific, Vivi said. I think you've lost weight.
Sida smiled, her mother's highest compliment.
I've filled out, Vivi said. It's the weightlifting, adds bulk. And the not smoking, adds Snickers bars.
Sida laughed. You are amazing with your weightlifting. I keep telling myself I should, but I never do.
Do I look too fat? Vivi asked.
Sida could not count the number of times her mother had asked her that question. Now, for the first time, she thought she heard what her mother was really asking.
Is that too much of me? Do I need to trim myself back for you?
No, Mama, Sida said. You don't look fat. There is just enough of you. Not too little. Not too much. In fact, you look exactly right.
Vivi kept staring straight ahead, out at the fields, only barely lit by moonlight.
Your father, she said, holding back tears, has put in over 300 acres of sunflowers out there. It's his second crop this season. Not cotton, not soybeans.
Sunflowers. Wait until you see them in the daylight. He claims it's to attract birds for hunting, but he's not fooling anybody.
You don't need 300 acres of sunflowers to attract a few little doves. I mean, all he does at the Labor Day dove hunt anymore is take photographs.
Vivi took a deep breath before she continued.
It's a Van Gogh out here, Sida. You think you know a man that you've put up with for nearly 50 years, and then it does something like that? All for beauty.
Vivi began to cry a little, but gave a deep sniffle and stopped. She patted lightly around her eyes with the tips of her fingers.
Splotchy. Splotchy's saddlebags.
Vivi turned so that Sida could clearly see her dark brown eyes, her faintly freckled milky skin, her aging chin. Then, in an exaggerated, petulant little girl voice, she said,
It's my party, and I'll cry if I want to.
Then Vivi burst out laughing. Sida joined her in laughter. God, it felt good to laugh with her mother again.
What made you do it? Vivi asked, looking at Sida. What made you get on a plane and fly all the way down here?
LaWanda, Sida said. LaWanda made me do it.
Vivi turned away. She was silent for a moment.
You didn't remove anything from my scrapbook, did you? You didn't lose anything, did you? Because that stuff is priceless. You can't put a price on any of those treasures.
I brought the divine secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood with me, Mama.
It's in the car. Let me get it right now. No, don't get up. That's all right.
But Sida was already walking toward the car. When she opened the car door, Vivi could see her daughter's wrinkled forehead in the illumination from the car light.
So beautiful and intent, Vivi thought, just like when she was little.
Sida walked back to the swing, carrying the scrapbook and a small gift-wrapped box, which she concealed in the pocket of her linen jacket. Sida handed the scrapbook to her mother.
I hand-carried it onto the plane with me. I didn't want anything to happen to it. I want this safely returned to me, your note said. Vivi stared at the album in her lap. She ran her hands over the package, then brought her hands up to her mouth.
"It's not the scrapbook I wanted safely returned," she whispered.
"Mother," Sitta said, smiling, "your note expressly said you'd take out a contract on me if
it was you I wanted to return safely to me," Vivi whispered.
"Oh, Mama," Sitta said, hardly able to speak. She laid her hand on her mother's shoulder. She could smell her mother's Hovet perfume, with its pears and violets and orris and vetiver cords so miraculously mixed. Underneath that scent, Sitta smelled Vivi's natural scent, the one that came from her skin, from the very molecules that made up her body. In the Louisiana night air, Sitta could smell again the first scent she ever breathed in. A light attached to a telephone pole at the edge of the driveway gave off an old-fashioned country light. It combined with the white Christmas lights strung around the swing to illuminate Vivi's face. Sitta could see the lines on her aging, almost translucent skin, lines formed from years of charm hiding fear. She could see her mother's courage. And she could see her pain. As Sitta joined Vivi in staring out into the darkness of the fields where hundreds of sunflowers grew, she thought, "I will never fully know my mother, any more than I will ever know my father, or Connor, or myself. I have been missing the point. The point is not knowing another person, or learning to love another person. The point is simply this: how tender can we bear to be? What good manners can we show as we welcome ourselves and others into our hearts?" There, in the front yard of Pecan Grove Plantation, in the heart of Louisiana, which had not yet had its first freeze of the year, Siddeley Walker gave up. She gave up the need to know, and she gave up the need to understand. She sat next to her mother and felt the power of their combined fragility. She returned home without blame. When Vivi reached out her hand to Sitta, she took it. Their hands rested on the swing between them. At the same moment, each of them looked down and noticed the similarity of their hands' coloring, the shape of their fingers, the veins that carried their ya-ya blood through their female bodies. "Oh, my," Vivi sighed. "Oh, my," Sitta echoed. With those few sounds, it was as though mother and daughter exchanged the same breath. Then, without a word, they began to push against the ground with their feet so that the swing began to rock ever so gently. Nothing rambunctious, just a smooth swaying, as if the swing were a cradle holding both mother and daughter, two separate and equal planets tumbling through space on a night in late autumn.
"I want to give you something," Vivi whispered.
She reached into the pocket of her silk pants. Then, taking Sitta's hand in hers, she slipped something into her daughter's palm. When Sitta unfolded her fingers, she beheld a small velvet jeweler's box. She opened the lid, which snapped back on a tight little hinge. Inside sat the diamond ring Vivi's father had given her over 50 years before.
"My father gave me this on the night of my 16th birthday," Vivi said simply. "I almost lost it once, but I got it back."
Then, like a priestess, Vivi took the ring from its box and slipped it onto her daughter's finger, her own hand shaking and soft and spotted with age. Once the ring was on, she raised Sitta's hand and kissed it. Not like you kiss a lover's hand, but like you kiss a baby's fingers, because they are so pink and pudgy, and because you love them so. Feeling her mother's tears against her palm, Sitta lifted Vivi's hand to her lips and kissed it before pressing it against her cheek. Then each of them began to cry. No shoulder shaking, no big gasps, just tears rolling down on their cheeks in silence. "Thank you, Mama," Sitta whispered, "for all the divine secrets you've shared."
"Secrets," Vivi said between sobs. "Oh, darling, if you're talking about my scrapbook, that was nothing. I don't even remember half the junk that was in there. You should see the stuff I didn't send you. Now that's where the real secrets are."
"This is my mother, all right," Sitta thought.
"I tell you," Vivi said, tears still falling, "it is a sin and a shame. They don't make Wanda Beauty anymore."
"Would sure come in handy for sinners like us," Sitta said, breaking the fifth rule of beauty and allure.
"My love lights are going to be dingy and lustless as hell.
Sparkleless in a setting of bags and puffs," Sitta said. "A girl has enough handicaps in the campaign for love."
"Goddamn right," Vivi said.
"Okay," Sitta whispered, "it's my turn." Reaching into her jacket pocket, she pulled out the tiny gift-wrapped box she had carried on the plane. Before she handed it to her mother, she gave the small gift a kiss, then slipped it into her mother's hand. Vivi tore the rose-colored handmade paper off the box. She reached in and very gently lifted out a tiny glass vessel about the size of a foxglove blossom. The vial was very old, made of sterling silver over glass, with one jade stone in the center of its little screw-on lid. Gingerly, Vivi unscrewed the top and held the vial to her nose to sniff it.
"It's not for perfume. It's for something else, isn't it?"
"Yes. It's for something else, Mama." Vivi tilted her head slightly to the side, thinking,
"Tell me."
"It's called a lacrimatory, a tiny jar of teardrops. In olden days, it was one of the greatest gifts you could give someone. It meant you loved them, that you shared a grief that brought you together."
"Oh, Sitta," Vivi said. "Oh, buddy.
This one dates back to Victorian times, I think. I found it in London a few years ago while scouring antique shops for props."
"Are your tears in here?" Vivi asked, holding up the vial.
"Yes, but there's room for more." Vivi looked at Sitta and winked. At least it looked like she was winking. She may have been trying to blink a tear, because in the next moment she was holding the tiny jar under her right eye, bobbing her head up and down, trying to shake her tears down into the container. Sitta looked at her mother and started laughing. Vivi looked at her and smiled.
"What are you laughing about, you crazy fool? I have been waiting for this gift my whole life."
"I know," Sitta said, now laughing and crying simultaneously. "I know." Then Vivi stood up from the swing, still holding the jar under her eyes, and began to hop, first on one foot and then on the other. Once she realized what her mother was doing, Sitta got up from the swing and began hopping too. She hopped first on her right leg and then on her left, leaning her eyes down in the direction of the lacrimatory so that her tears might fall in. Vivi, holding a jar of tears in her hand, and Sitta, wearing a once-pawned, now-redeemed ring on her finger, hopped and cried. Hopped and cried and laughed and made wild, impromptu whooping sounds. If someone had happened upon them, they might have thought the two women were performing a strange ritual tribal dance. The ritual mother-daughter dance of the almost lost but still mighty tribe of divine Yayas. An ancient passage of tears and diamonds. Diamonds. And tears. Chapter 32. It was after 1 a.m. when Sitta and Connor checked into the Tanta Marie house on Cane River.
It's straight out of a movie,
Connor whispered as they walked up to the front door of an early Creole Greek revival home. Columns lined the deep porch, and the air was fragrant with thick, sweet smells. The flickering of gas lamps created shadows that danced along the shutters and brick walls, making Sitta and Connor feel they had stepped back into another century. The owner introduced himself as Thomas LeConte. By the time he had led Connor and Sitta through a courtyard garden and up a flight of stairs into a gallery apartment in the old slave quarters beyond his house, he decided that not only did he know Sitta's family, but there was probably a good chance that the two of them were related.
As a matter of fact, Thomas said, stepping through the French doors out onto a gallery that looked down upon the garden, that camellia bush over there, a Lady Hume's blush, came from plantings your maternal grandmother gave my father. I think her name was Mary Catherine Bowman Abbott, wasn't it? A tremendous gardener, your grandmother. My father was, too, a camellia nut. When a camellia blossom fell, he spoke of it as a beheading. Daddy would kill me if he saw the way my gardener has pruned your grandmother's jewel.
Beside him on the gallery, Sitta and Connor looked down on the garden, a wild profusion of blooming begonias, impatiens, and the remnants of big, showy caladium leaves. The sweet scent of butterfly ginger, its white flowers glowing in the darkness, reached up to greet them. Surrounded by the tangled masses of Spanish moss hanging from giant live oaks, the garden was enclosed by old brick walls, which were covered by a few remaining Rose of Montana blossoms. A fountain with a small pool sat in the far corner of the garden, buttressed on one side by a chinaberry tree and on the other by a crepe myrtle, its leaves gold and red with autumn. Lush plantings of a variety of camellias, azaleas, roses of all kinds, salvias, and jasmine filled the space so completely that the red brick floor of the courtyard was barely visible. Sitta looked at the huge camellia bush, its buds full and swollen. I never knew Buggy, that's what we call my grandmother, was such a great gardener, Sitta said.
Oh, well, Thomas said, that sort of thing is only known among the true gardeners, you know.
Then making the sign of the cross, he muttered,
Daddy, forgive me.
Connor, a true gardener, said,
That variety of camellia is legendary, Sitta.
A Lady Hume's blush, that size, is comparable to a black pearl. I didn't think they really existed.
I must let you get to bed, Thomas said.
Connor and Sitta watched as he descended the stairs.
I can't believe I'm in America, Connor said.
You aren't, Sitta said. You're in Louisiana.
And we're about to spend the night in converted slave quarters that look like they're straight out of Southern Living. It makes me feel a little guilty. All the misery these four walls have held. Connor looked around the living room, filled with antiques, plush carpets, and Audubon prints. A lot of misery, yes. But life happened here, too. Couples made love, babies were born, people sang as well as wept. These walls have probably witnessed joy along with the suffering. After they'd fallen back into the huge four-poster bed, Sitta told Connor the bare bones of her reunion with her mother. She did not feel much like talking, though. They made love briefly, intensely, sleepily, sweetly. They were both exhausted. After their lovemaking, Sitta did not fall asleep. Connor stroked her back and made up little bits of a song for her, something about a little bulb growing underground in winter. He sang softly until finally his voice drifted off, and he fell asleep. If God is good to me, Sitta thought, I will be sharing a bed with this man when I am 80. After a few moments, Sitta climbed out of the bed, careful not to wake Connor. Naked, she walked barefoot across the wide, cypress-plank floors and down into the garden, into the warm, humid Louisiana night. She stood in front of the camellia that was her grandmother's black pearl. Then she crossed to the fountain and dipped her hands into the small pool. Her fingers wet, she touched her eyes, then her lips, then her breasts. She breathed in and out. She offered herself mercy. She gave herself forgiveness. Sometimes lost treasures can be reclaimed. The next morning, Sidda spooned up against Connor and suggested they do things together she had never done before within 100-mile radius of her hometown. After that, she whispered a few decisive words to him. When he heard what she had to say, he pulled her to him without speaking and held her. He kissed her forehead, her eyes, then her nose, her lips, then the tips of her fingers. "I'm sorry for all my crazy indecisions," she said, "for making you hang on a thread over the canyon of doom." "Aw, sweet pea," Connor said, rolling back onto his side so that he looked into her eyes. "We're all hanging by a thread in the canyon of doom. We're all each other's keepers." The deep kindness in his eyes, the tenderness in his voice, erased any smidgen of doubt that she had made the right decision. By noon, they were at Pecan Grove, drinking iced tea with Vivi and Shep on the back patio. Willetta was also in attendance to witness Siddeley Walker's announcement that she would marry Connor McGill in exactly 7 days in the sunflower field in front of her parents' home. Within approximately 30 minutes, 3 cars appeared in the drive. The Yayas had arrived. Now the show could get on the road. Chapter 33. In her father's field of sunflowers, early on the evening of October 25th, wearing her mother's wedding dress, Siddeley Walker said yes to Connor McGill. Surrounded by her parents, her brothers and their families, her sister Lulu, who'd flown home from Paris, the Yayas, the Petit Yayas, and their families, Willetta and her family, her friend May Sorensen, who'd arrived at the last moment from Turkey, Connor's parents, one grandparent, and 2 sisters, Wade Conan, who'd escorted Huey Lean and who had recut Vivi's wedding dress so that it plunged and dipped and showed Sidda's shoulders, and a host of other friends who'd rearranged their lives to fly to Thornton on a week's notice, Siddeley Walker said to Connor McGill, "I will love you with tenderness in the best way I know how." Sidda's 7-year-old niece, Caitlin Walker, one of Baylor's twins, was responsible for the fact that all the children, and also several of the adults, were wearing Halloween costumes. A stranger happening on the ceremony might have mistaken the gathering for a well-heeled group of pagan worshippers, if it hadn't been for the fact that Teensy's cousin was playing Amazing Grace on a Cajun fiddle. At the party afterward, that same fiddler and the rest of his band, Alligator Gree-Gree, played a combination of Cajun and Zydeco, mixed in with old standards from the 40s they'd been forced to learn in order to make a living on the South Louisiana country club circuit. Under the huge old live oak, which Baylor had strung with 1 million tiny Christmas lights, Shep Walker supervised a cochon du lait, delighting the New Yorkers with heaping plates of roast pig and dirty rice. Willetta's husband, Cheney, stood over a huge black kettle filled with fresh shrimp and long tables stacked with fresh French bread, salad, and 1,000 Louisiana specialties lined the dance area. Sunflowers and zinnias, which Niecy had arranged, were everywhere, and bales of hay circled a bonfire tended by Little Shep. The weather was perfect, with just a little nip in the air, so everybody could dance without getting too sweaty. It was about as loose and happy a wedding party as folks had ever witnessed. Midway through the party, once everyone had eaten, the band stopped playing, and the squeeze-box accordion player announced that a special treat was in store. With that, he stepped aside and introduced the 4 Yayas. Stepping up to the microphone, Vivi Abbott Walker lifted her glass of champagne to the heavens, winked, and said, "Siddeley, darling, this song is for you." After taking a healthy sip of the champagne, Vivi signaled to the others. Then, in four-part ya-ya harmony, accompanied by a fiddle, accordion, and bass, the four old friends began to sing. Their voices were not particularly fine. Their harmony was a little slippery, but when they opened their mouths, what came out was part lullaby, part love song, part benediction. They sang, "Nights are long since you went away. I think about you all through the day. My buddy, no buddy quite so true. Miss your voice, the touch of your hand. Just long to know that you understand. My buddy, your buddy, misses you." By the time the song was over, Sitta had reconciled herself to the fact that in every single one of her wedding pictures, her face would be streaked by long black threads of mascara from crying so much. When her father came up from behind and handed her his handkerchief, she was grateful.
"Your mama and them was still rehearsing when I went to bed last night," Shep said.
Sitta looked at her father and smiled. "Thank you for growing those sunflowers, Daddy," she said.
"You know, that's my second crop this year. Don't know what possessed me to grow sunflowers this late in the season. I caught a lot of ribbon about growing flowers after spending my whole life growing money crops clear up to the front door. That was a different time in my life, though. I had four of y'all to feed, buy cars for, send through college. Now I grow things for different reasons. Still, I'm glad you and Con came along and made it look like those sunflowers have some reason for being there. Keeps me from looking like I've gone all soft. Gotta keep up my image, you know."
Sitta reached up and gently wiped the tears away from her father's cheeks. "I love you, Daddy."
"I hope your marriage is a good one, baby doll," he said. "Maybe we can all be more like a family now, if you know what I mean."
"Yes, Daddy," Sitta said, linking her arm with her father's. "I know what you mean."
"Don't you think it's time for a father-daughter dance?" Vivi said as she stepped up.
She gave Sitta a kiss on the cheek, then kissed her husband.
"I think what the American family needs is more dancing, don't y'all?"
Sitta looked first at her mother, then at her father. "I think you're right, Mama. In fact, I think somebody should include that in a presidential platform." As the band kicked back in, Vivi took Sitta's face in hers and kissed her once more. Then, taking Sitta's hand and placing it in Shep's, she gave them a little push toward the dance floor.
"Shake a tail feather, darlings," she said. "Cut a rug."
With that, Vivi went off in search of the ya-yas, and soon the four of them were dancing together, their dresses swirling, their eyes shining. After the wedding cake, baked by Willetta and decorated by her daughter Pearl with Halloween colors, was cut, everybody hit the dance floor again. Even though it was getting late and the toddlers were sleepy-eyed, nobody wanted to leave Pecan Grove Plantation. Nobody wanted to stop celebrating. Instead, they stayed and danced. They waltzed, they jerked, they Cajun two-stepped, they mashed potatoed, they jitterbugged, they foxtrotted. They boogied their little hearts out. From her perch on the crescent of the harvest moon, the Holy Lady looked down and smiled at her imperfect children. The angels attending her that night felt little twinges of longing to be in human form, if for only a few minutes. They wanted to rock, they wanted to roll, they wanted to feel the peculiarly human feeling of having a perfect night in an imperfect world. They wanted to taste the saltiness of tears, the way Sitta did, the way Vivi did, the way, if truth be told, almost everyone did on the night Sitta Walker wed Connor McGill. So it is when an umbilical cord of love flows up from the earth and down from the sky. So it is sometimes near Halloween in the state of Louisiana when the divisions between heaven and earth crack open a little and spirits gather from all over. Perhaps the souls of Sida's twin and Jack and Genevieve Whitman joined in the festivities that night. Perhaps little unborn spirits in the cracked hearts of each of the guests were called forth. When the dancers spoke, breathless, happy, in between songs, they told each other the night was charmed. They told each other it felt like some kind of spell had been put on them. To this, the Blessed Mother only winked. To this, she would only say, "Them that know, don't tell. And them that tell, don't know." For Siddeley Walker, the need to understand had passed, at least for the moment. All that was left was love and wonder. Acknowledgements. With special thanks to the following. Maura Holbert Hogeboom, my mentor, whose love, acceptance, and inspiration has taught me how wide and sweet and wild motherhood and sisterhood can be. Terry Gibson, a lighthouse with a steady beam. Diane Reverend, my editor, who intuitively and enthusiastically embraced the Yayas when this book was a bebe. Jane Isay, unbidden angel, who appeared and with great kindness helped me refine and structure my thoughts. Donna Lambden, Louisiana's sister, and Bob Corbett, who introduced me to Lake Quinault. Jan Constantine, for her generous advice and friendship. Tom Wells, my brother, whom I love. Note to the reader. I am grateful to Liz Huddle and Burke Walker, who shared their experiences of being stage directors with me and thus helped shape the character of Sida Walker. I will always be thankful to Adrienne Rich for her seminal book of Woman Born, which inspired and coached me as I wrote this novel. Thanks also to Diane Ackerman, whose ability to express the beauty of the physical world woke me up. I thank Denise Levitoff for her poem, The Annunciation, which sparks the Holy Lady to show up sometimes when the moon is right. I'm grateful to Weavings for publishing Forgiveness, The Name of Love in a Wounded World, an essay by Henry Nguyen. I'm grateful to The Sun for its wonderful sunbeams, which published both the Mary Anton and H.L. Mencken quotes that are used as epigraphs.
This production of Divine Secrets of the Yaya Sisterhood was written by Rebecca Wells and performed by Judith Ivy. Copyright 1996 by Rebecca Wells. Production copyright 2002 by HarperCollins Publishers. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.